Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From middle school students in Royal Oak chanting "Build the Wall" to a Canton police officer suspended for a racist Facebook post to a Muslim student at U of M who reports she was confronted by a man who threatened to set her on fire if she didn't remove her hijab. These are just a few of the incidents reported in Michigan since last week's election of Donald Trump, an election which came after a long campaign that often focused on Muslims. Dawood Waleed is the executive director of the Michigan chapter of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Dawood, what have you been hearing from Muslims in Michigan since Election Day?
I've heard a great amount of concern from Muslims in this state, and not just because of some events that have taken place here, but the seemingly high amount of racist and xenophobic attacks that have taken place to people of color all throughout the country. Last I checked, from Tuesday to Saturday, the Southern Poverty Law Center had written down or had noted a little over 200 attacks or incidences that were related to hate after the election. So this is traveling on people's Facebook and Twitter, and people are getting calls from family members in other states. So there's a high level of concern within the Muslim community about not just was taking place, particularly to us, but also the general state of intolerance that seems to be in our society right now.
Mr. Trump last night on 60 Minutes, he called on his supporters to stop it with harassment and intimidation and attacks. What do you think of the president-elect's statement?
Well, it reeks of some insincerity considering his chief strategist, Mr. Bannon, is part of the alt-right and is a well-known anti-Semite, Islamophobe, white nationalist. So I don't know, you know, what Mr. Trump is talking about, where he says cut it out on one hand, and then he's in his transition team looking at putting in his cabinet known white nationalists who are bigots against people of color. So I don't find what he's saying to be sincere at all.
Dawood, there's no one Muslim point of view, and there are Muslim Americans who voted for Donald Trump. How do you want CARE to represent all Muslim Americans in Michigan, those who are alarmed at what a Trump presidency will mean and those who voted for it?
Well, we're a nonpartisan group, so we neither took a stance for Mr. Trump or against Mr. Trump. But what we are concerned about is bigotry, discrimination, and hate crimes, not just against Muslims, but all groups of people that are discriminated against based upon their national background, race, or religion. So whether there are Muslims who voted for Trump or not is really besides the point. We have a very toxic climate in our country right now, and the amount of hatred that Muslims have faced since in the past year with this presidential election cycle has actually been unprecedented in American history. It wasn't even this bad shortly after 9/11.
We know CARE called for an investigation into that incident that I referred to in Ann Arbor of an apparently intoxicated man threatening a Muslim woman he would set her on fire if she didn't remove her hijab. So here's the question, Dawood. When we hear of these stories, what do we do with that? We as the public, how should we respond? How do we process this?
Well, the first thing is we should take it seriously, because a couple of months ago in New York City on Fifth Avenue, there was a Muslim woman who was set on fire, and people in our community know this, so this is not an unprecedented situation. So one, it should be taken seriously. The second thing is that in our discussions about communities being marginalized or being targets of hate, the Muslim community should not be excluded from that conversation, meaning that even with Mr. Bannon, I've seen people talk about how he's anti-Semitic, how he's anti-LGBTQ, but then there's not the same mentions about him being a well-known anti-Muslim bigot. So it shouldn't be an issue of the erasure of Islamophobia, but then the addressing of other forms of bigotry by white nationalists and white supremacists. That's something else I think needs to be highlighted. Islamophobia is real, and in discussions about intolerance in America, that the anti-Muslim bigotry should not be erased or treated as something that is just like not a real issue in America.
Dawood, there's been a lot of talk since leading up to Election Day, certainly since then, about the great divisions we have right now in America, in our society, and how we need to figure out a way to come together. And I'm wondering, have you heard from other groups in Michigan since the election, perhaps groups you haven't worked with before, who do want to join with you and work with you to increase understanding, increase the exchange?
No, what I have heard from is already existing allies. I actually had a dinner at a friend of mine who's a rabbi with some other clergy, Jewish and Christian, where we were talking about the challenges and how we're going to help try to motivate our faith communities to work closer together. But as far as reaching out to other people outside of our allies, we have not heard anything from any other communities that we weren't already working with, nor have we really taken time to reach out, simply because this is a very polarizing time right now, and people are in their feelings, and people have bunkered down into their position. So we're hoping that things are going to cool down before we try to engage in any dialogues or discussions with people on the right in particular, who were perhaps, you know, supporting some of Mr. Trump's white nationalist rhetoric as far as his stances pertaining to Syrian refugees and immigrants in particular.
Dawood, do you feel that this will kind of simmer down with a little bit of time? It's been less than a week.
It may simmer down some, and then again, it may pick up at the inauguration, but I would just tell people that this isn't just something that happened overnight. Our country has been very polarized since President Barack Obama got sworn to office, with the ascension of the Tea Party movement and a lot of racism that is really escalated in our country. So this fire was not just started with the election of Donald Trump, and I don't think it's going to go out anytime soon.
Dawood Waleed, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Dawood, we want to thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Time to check in for the week with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. And John, the Lions didn't have to lift a finger, and lo and behold, first place in the NFC North.
They should do that more often, not play in advance.
Let's hear it for bye weeks. Well, based on what you've seen, especially from Stafford, do you think Detroit has any kind of real shot at winning this division title?
They'll have a chance for two reasons. One, he actually is playing his best football of his career. He is playing finally the way he's supposed to be playing 9 years ago when they drafted him from Georgia. And give my man, Jim Bob Cooter, offensive coordinator for the Detroit Lions, all-time great name, I think from Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
Second thing is, right now, this division is not very good. The Packers have got their problem out of Green Bay. Minnesota's a good team, but they've got their problems too. So I'll tell you that it's possible. Having said that, there's a long history of them not doing this. So
stumbling as it comes across the
finish line. You've been warned.
All right, we'll watch and see. Over to college football, where after this weekend, there are now two unbeaten teams left in the hunt for a playoff spot or a bowl bid. And you got Alabama, and you have our own Western Michigan.
Two of them used to be in the state of Michigan, and now there's one of them, and it's Western Michigan. I don't know if you would have bet on that.
Absolutely.
In August, they beat, by the way, two Big Ten teams to get there, so not a cheesy schedule either. They are now 10-0, by the way, and the games ahead, they've got Toledo in 2 weeks, a very good Toledo team, 8-2. Nonetheless, P.J. Fleck has got his team, the Broncos, playing extremely well. They are almost certainly going to get a New Year's Day bowl if they win out.
That is amazing. You think ESPN's bringing College Game Day to Kalamazoo for the first time this Saturday?
We'll have to draw them a map because they've never been there before. So good job, Broncos.
Oh, boy. Over to Michigan, as you say, no longer an unbeaten team, losing to Iowa. What did you learn about the Wolverines in this loss?
They are vulnerable, which I always thought they were. I never thought, as we've discussed, I never thought they were a dominant team, that they can just crush anybody the way Alabama tends to.
And here it was, big national TV audience. Ouch.
Big national TV audience. And we also talked last week about Iowa playing there is very tough. And we said this and tweeted it and all the rest. They pack 70,000 fans. It's a very steep incline on the stands. Look, man, it's an 8 o'clock at night game. These people don't live in Iowa. They drive in from Minneapolis and Chicago and Milwaukee and places like that. They get there at 8 o'clock in the morning. They go all day. Then they get in a stadium to cheer their team on. You heard them on TV. Yeah. It's a loud bunch. Michigan played its worst game of the year.
And so what needs to be fixed going forward?
Just about everything. It was a step back. Don't rebuild everything.
But it didn't blow up the season, and
Up in fact, they still, if they went out, they'll still get to the playoffs. Okay. That's amazing. Offensive line was very weak. Wilden Spate, the quarterback, had its worst game and might be banged up. He's a righty, but his left arm still matters, and his shoulder got popped pretty badly. So that'll be an issue we're going to be watching. Defense played very well. They held the Iowa Hawkeyes to 12 points, two were against the offense, but also showed some weaknesses here and there. The wide receivers played their worst also.
Some smiling faces for a change in East Lansing.
Yes. How about that? You beat Rutgers.
Yeah, but it was Rutgers.
but it's better than losing to Rutgers.
Well, this is true. And it was a shutout.
It was a shutout. It felt good at home. Nice sunny day. And now you've got two games left. They could be a gigantic spoiler. Because right now you got a three-way race for the Eastern title. It's Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State. And Michigan State plays two of them coming up. They've got Ohio State this weekend, and they've got Penn State the next weekend. You beat either one of those teams, and they're out. So Michigan State's got a great chance to play spoiler.
And which means we might see some Michigan fans actually rooting for Sparty?
It's funny how, no matter how rational it is, even though you know you need help in this front or that front, these various fan groups cannot root for their opponent, even when it's in their best interest.
That's
just can't do it.
So funny. When you talk about what college football means, and you just take a look and see what happened to some very big names, when you think about, you know, numbers 2, 3, and 4 in the polls all got beaten. Clemson and Washington joining Michigan
right.
in the loser's corner hasn't happened since 1985 when Ronald Reagan was president.
Ronald Reagan was president. Michigan was number two. Iowa was number one. They go to Iowa. The quarterback was a young man named Jim Harbaugh. They lost 12-10 on 4 field goals, which is why Bo hated field goal kickers. 31 years later, same stuff.
And you just never know from week to week.
Why I love that game.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubank. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's no better way to understand where we're headed than to understand where we've been, in other words, through history. Let's see what history might tell us about Donald Trump's victory and the turmoil and division that's been left in the wake of this long, tough campaign. Here with us is historian Gleaves Whitney, director of Grand Valley State University's Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies. Gleaves, you and I talked last spring about the very blunt, sometimes coarse tone that Mr. Trump took in the campaign, and there was certainly more of that as the months rolled on. And yet, here we are today, talking about President-elect Donald Trump. So that tone helped him win the White House.
Well, it really did. I mean, the country is in a populist mood, and the Republican Party, which used to be very much a bifurcated party, which is to say that you had your elites who would read National Review and read T.S. Eliot poetry, and they were part of the conservative intellectual movement, and then you had the populists. And there have been people in the past, such as Ronald Reagan, who were able to bring those two together. Well, the elites got left out in the cold in this election, and the populace really won the day. And Donald Trump, I think, has demonstrated he was in tune. He has a genius for reaching these folks, and they came out for him. One of the most interesting techniques, one of the most interesting things that we learned after this election as we started to analyze what happened, is that we kept saying, oh, well, Hillary Clinton had a ground game. You know, she had all these people who could canvass the neighborhoods and make the phone calls. They had a traditional campaign structure out there. Trump does not have that, therefore he's going to lose. It might be just by small margins, but he will lose. Well, of course, what they weren't factoring in is we had all of these rallies. We saw the rallies. The rallies brought people who were going to go home and tell somebody to get out and vote, or two people to get out and vote. And then all of a sudden, that rally of 10,000 people turned into 30,000 voters. And that's what did it.
In what ways, Gleaves, do you think Donald Trump is totally shattering the presidential mold? Certainly, as you say, his campaign was totally unconventional. But what about the man himself?
Well, it's interesting, Cindy. This is the first president we've had who comes from a business background, who did not serve either in government or in the military, to win the White House. So he's remarkable in that sense. He really does reflect a mass culture that we have not seen in a candidate before. I mean, contrast him with Bill Clinton, say, who is elected in 1992 and can go on Arsenio Hall and play a musical instrument and really wow a young crowd. So who had a populist touch, to be sure, but wasn't so much part of popular culture because, of course, President Clinton had been a governor of Arkansas for many years. So this is a new phenomenon we're seeing in American history, and I'm trying to think. There are aspects of Donald Trump that remind us of other people. We think maybe of Andrew Jackson, who won the popular vote in 1824 and then gets the presidency outright in 1828, 1832, passes it on to Van Buren in 1836. Jackson was very much a man of the people. And we've all, I think, heard the stories now of how Jackson's inauguration got totally out of control, where the masses of people, the new Democratic man, so to speak, was coming in, crashing the party, stealing the silverware, people running out of the window, you know, climbing out of the windows with things tucked under their arms. I mean, it was a mob scene in the Jackson White House of 1828 in that first inauguration. So we see maybe a little bit of an echo of the populism in an Andrew Jackson. Then you see a little bit of the populism in a character like Huey Long in the 1930s, who was going to challenge Franklin Roosevelt for the presidency. Huey Long, of course, is assassinated and does not have the opportunity to make that run for the White House that everyone thought he would. But he also had the common touch. He had the ability to see what the anxieties, the fears were of the common person, the forgotten man, so-called. So there are some precedents that near Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is sui generis.
Okay, for those who didn't take Latin?
Oh, unique.
There you go. So in other words, we've never had a more outsidery outsider.
That's right. I think that that's true. Donald Trump is such an interesting character, though, also, because let's look at his political past to the extent that he has been involved in politics. He's been a Democrat for most of his life. He certainly has contributed to a lot of Democrats. We've been talking about Bill Clinton's presidency. He contributed to the first Clinton, who was on the national stage politically. He has contributed to Nancy Pelosi and her political campaign. So this is a man who is really hard to nail down exactly what he is. He's very chameleon-like. He's very, I think, very savvy in making his way from group to group to group, depending on what he needs to see done. There's really a lot we just don't know.
One thing we do know, Gleaves, is the division and the rancor that we saw during the campaign has certainly something we're dealing with now in the aftermath of the election. And I'm wondering, I'm thinking back to 1968 when Richard Nixon beat Hubert Humphrey. Did we have that kind of division? Were we that badly divided and hurting?
We have had serious division, and you allude to 1968. The Chicago Convention for the Democrats was a cultural marker for a nation deeply divided by the Vietnam War, civil rights, the resentment against civil rights. The new environmental movement is just beginning to take off that year. You have a lot of forces that are tearing the country apart, and then the silent majority, of course, are the ones who come in and give a pretty strong victory to Richard Nixon, the Republican, over the Democratic nominee Hubert Humphrey. And Nixon is going to claim that he is the president who can bring us together. And one of the ways he does that is to make earnest efforts to end the Vietnam War, which had become now a bipartisan issue. How do you get out of this war with anything that's resembling a victory? It was hard to do, but it was enough to give Richard Nixon such a boost that he was able to come in on a landslide in 1972 for a second term. But then we know what happened after that with Watergate,
yes,
and he has to resign in shame. But these things happen with people. When we are very divided, we're looking for somebody who maybe has that magic touch, who has the finger on our pulse as a people. A lot of people have said, we're hungering for that, but Donald Trump's not the best instrument to do it. He's the messenger that maybe we didn't want. Time will have to tell. I thought that Secretary Clinton was very gracious in her concession speech on Wednesday, last Wednesday, when she said, you know, we owe him a good listen and the opportunity to lead. We owe him that. See what he does. Look at the first 100 days. What's the tone that is set? We might be surprised. I might be surprised as a presidential observer. He might reach out to Democrats on a number of potential proposals that I can think of where there's a lot of common ground, and thus prove not only to be a populist with a lot of the people who were attracted to him, but even in Washington, a unifier of sorts if he plays his cards right. I could see Trump, for example, saying, look, we need to do more to build up our infrastructure. I'm a builder. In fact, I heard him compared to Theodore Roosevelt already. He's going to be thinking big. How does he make the presidency big again and transform this nation in a way that both Republicans and Democrats, that all the people will appreciate? Well, Democrats, of course, have wanted great spending bills on infrastructure, and I think this might be a year where Republicans will go along with it, too. I also think that Donald Trump has a natural aversion, it seems, to getting too far out there in the world and his foreign policy. I think a lot of Democrats who traditionally were called doves share that with him. He might be able to find common ground and be able to say, you know, maybe we don't want to get involved in that part of the world. Let's let our allies do it or see what happens. Some Democrats have been very concerned about Obamacare. The hikes, the Affordable Care Act, did not deliver all that was promised. Trump is the kind of guy he likes. You know, he's not ideological. You can't really say he's a Republican or a Democrat. You can't say he's a conservative or a progressive. He likes just getting things done. He loves the negotiating process. So I think, sort of in the manner of TR, Theodore Roosevelt at the beginning of the 1900s, I'm hoping that Donald Trump will reach out on both sides of the aisle, say, we've got to turn over a new page. There are a lot of issues that this country faces in our foreign policy, in our domestic, our debt, our national debt, for example. These are the kinds of finance things he might be attracted to attack and form a bipartisan movement to attack. We're just hoping we'll have to wait and see.
Gleaves Whitney, director of Grand Valley State University's Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Gleaves.
Thank you very much.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
Moments of play, of succeeding in some kind of athletic endeavor. Those childhood and school moments can last a lifetime. So how do children with disabilities get their chance to experience these very same special moments? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea took that question and she made it her life's work. Leah Ketchison got her PhD in kinesiology from the University of Michigan. These days, she is the executive director of LightUp. It's a group that develops research-based programs for adults and children who have special needs. And among them is an innovative program called Spectrum of Sports as they partner with Wayne State University. Leah Ketchison, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Leah, tell us, first of all, what is the mission of LightUp and, in turn, Spectrum of Sports?
The mission of LightUp is to improve the quality of life of individuals with disabilities across the lifespan through programming in the physical and social domain.
So that's right to the point. And Spectrum of Sports looks at the youngsters, doesn't it?
That's right. So Spectrum of Sports, we really wanted to create a program which would provide youth with disabilities the fundamental motor skills that were related to future participation in physical activity and future social opportunities. So we've really targeted these key fundamental motor skills which have been linked to that behavior later on in life. And that's really Spectrum of Sports. We start with this intense fundamental motor skill acquisition, followed by an opportunity to practice these skills in team sports and in games.
And to do that, we get into the concept of adapted physical education and adapted sports, don't we? What are we talking about?
All quality physical education is actually adapted physical education. So what we're doing is tailoring the needs of the individual to be able to maximize their opportunity for successful participation in physical activity. So, for example, if a child is working on catching a ball, well, we might start with a larger ball that's a little bit easier to catch and a lighter ball that's easier to catch. And then we might sort of move down the spectrum of what we would be gradually more and more difficult to catch and or to throw. We really try to tailor the instruction to meet the individual needs of the child. And that's really the crux of adapted physical education and adapted sport.
And why does this matter physically and emotionally to children with disabilities?
there are key skills that are linked to future opportunities to engage in team sports and be social later on in development. We're trying to intervene at a time that's sensitive in development in order to change these trajectories throughout the course of a lifetime. In terms of the social domain, there is research to support the more opportunities that we can give children at a young age to acquire these skills, the more likely they are to have social opportunities later on in life.
Honestly, as you point out in your essay for The Next Idea, schools can only do so much, can't they?
Right, and schools are limited by what is state-mandated physical education. Many schools might have one or two opportunities per week lasting 25 to 35 minutes. We found, based on feedback from parents and what we're finding in our research, that's just not enough to make a significant change in the children's lives with disabilities. We have developed these specific programs that can supplement what they might be learning in school and make it continuous. Our goal is every time we launch a program at LightUp, we want to sustain this program.
And as you say, it's across the age spectrum. I'm interested in the partnership you've created with Wayne State University for a spectrum of sports. So this is the idea is let's augment what youngsters might be getting through school or limited numbers of special programs. What does Spectrum of Sports consist of?
Spectrum of Sports is a fantastic program. As part of my affiliation with Wayne State as an adjunct faculty, we are supplementing the undergraduate and graduate student experience at Wayne State with a practicum component. They're enrolled in a class called Adaptive Physical Activity, where they are required to participate in a number of contact hours with individuals with disabilities. These students are being trained week to week on how to best instruct children with disabilities. And I do that as the first part of the lecture. As the second part of the class, we moved into the gym where these students work one-to-one in a ratio of one-to-one with undergraduate or graduate degree students, along with a child from the Detroit area, where they are going to receive, every single student receives direct individualized instruction in a one-to-one ratio.
And how many students are you working with at any given time?
There are 30 youth ages 4 to 13 with disabilities enrolled in this program.
How easily could this idea be spread out from Wayne State to across Michigan?
That's what we love about LightUp, because this methodology is really replicable across any environment that has the built environment like a gymnasium and access to either high school students or university students who want to work in this one-to-one ratio where we can teach the children the skills necessary to acquire the fundamental motor skills in a small ratio. This can be adopted across any community that has access to a large gymnasium and sort of limited equipment, and then access to eager volunteers and to parents who want to give their children this opportunity.
For your students at Wayne State who are working with these youngsters with disabilities, when you hear back from them, what have you heard? What surprises them about working with these children?
For many of the students in my classes, this is their first opportunity to work with a child with a disability. And it's amazing. I think that their reflection, it's that they're amazed at the capacity of every single child. It doesn't matter what type of disability it is, whether a single limb is affected or whether a child is nonverbal or they're limited in some other physical capacity. They are amazed that following this program, how much the child can actually do with this direct individualized instruction.
And underlying all of this is the fact that everything you do at LightUp is research-based.
Yes, we have partnered with the Sunfield Center, which is a behavioral health clinic here in Ann Arbor, and they are really our subject matter experts that are helping us to deliver only the most research-informed practices. So we're taking a lot of what's been published in the social and communication domains, most recently the motor domain, and we're implementing that into our program. So every single one of them has the most research-informed supported strategies implemented into these programs.
Well, you can certainly find out lots more about LightUp's programs, whether you want to see about getting a youngster involved in Spectrum of Sports or seeing what it might take to be able to bring this to your community by going to their website, lightupnow.org. That's lightupnow.org. And, of course, you'll find Leah's essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Leah Ketchison, great work and exciting prospects, I think, and it'll be fascinating to watch this spread through Michigan as more and more people learn about what you're doing at LightUp.
Thank you so much.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Since the election of Donald Trump, there has certainly been an increase nationwide in reports of harassment and intimidation of minorities. One such incident is making headlines in Traverse City, involving a police officer named Michael Peters. Aaron Selbig of Interlochen Public Radio is here with more. Aaron, this started last Friday at a Love Trump's Hate rally.
That's right. On Veterans Day, there was a rally near downtown Traverse City, and this officer Peters showed up in his truck. He was off duty, and in the back of his truck, he had a giant Confederate flag. And apparently, according to witnesses, he got out of his truck, he drank a beer, and he engaged with some of the protesters there.
In what way?
We don't know exactly what he said. There are witnesses who were there who were clearly upset and agitated by his presence. He was engaging with them. We don't know the exact words, but these witnesses have been invited by the police department to come forward and tell their story to folks who are investigating this.
And how has the city responded to date?
There are two investigations, an internal investigation looking at whether this officer violated the code of conduct of the Traverse City Police Department. And there's also a criminal investigation wondering whether he violated any laws regarding the alcohol. It's a little bit unclear on whether it was legal to drink a beer where he was in a parking lot next to a park.
And so what's Officer Peters' status as of today?
He is suspended with pay pending the investigation.
And Police Chief Jeff O'Brien had a press conference. What was his message to people in Traverse City?
He urged patience on the part of the community. Since this happened on Friday, it's gotten a lot of attention. I think most people are upset with this officer's actions. Others are defending his right to free speech and expressing himself. Chief O'Brien urged patience while the investigation and the process plays itself out. But he also spoke personally about his own experience. He was in the Army in Fort McClellan, Alabama in the 70s, and he said he witnessed segregation up close during that time. And he said that he doesn't approve of the Confederate flag. He thinks the Confederate flag belongs in a museum. Those were his words.
And has anyone been able to get any kind of comment from Officer Peters?
No, not that I know of. He was not present at the press conference. He met with Chief O'Brien this morning, and the chief announced that his suspension in the investigations. But no, to my knowledge, Officer Peters has not spoken out.
And that was Aaron Selbig, Interlochen Public Radio. And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about? Just let us know. Find us on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Donald Trump gave his first interview as president-elect to Leslie Stahl on CBS 60 Minutes. Speaking last night, Mr. Trump had this to say about what some of his supporters have reportedly been doing to minorities.
Do you want to say anything to those people?
I would say don't do it. That's terrible. Because I'm going to bring this country together.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
With us now is Susan Reed, managing attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Cindy.
Along with the other incidents that we kind of have talked about, have you heard of other incidents of harassment directly?
You know, we have. We are a statewide legal resource center for immigrant communities, and we work with a lot of bilingual attorneys and advocates in mutual aid organizations, service organizations that serve Latino, Arab, Muslim, and other immigrant-rich communities around the state. And I've received, I would say, dozens of emails from attorneys who say, you know, my client told me this, they don't want to report it, they don't want to tell anyone, but, you know, are you collecting information about this kind of incidents? There are civil rights organizations who track this kind of reporting that are saying that the numbers they're seeing are trending worse than 9/11, and that's consistent with our experience as well.
That was, I think, a question a lot of people have. Is this a true spike, or is it because we're hypersensitive and paying closer attention to something that maybe has been happening all along?
I feel very certain that it's a true spike. This is very different than anything we've seen before, and it's happening in ways and in places that we hadn't seen before. I certainly, from the anecdotes that I'm receiving, see a trend of emboldening of people who might have otherwise felt some stronger social pressure to be quiet.
If someone ends up in a situation where they're witnessing this kind of harassment or intimidation, what are some things that we can do?
Well, certainly, I mean, contacting the local police, if that's feasible. I mean, if you're in a public situation that's unsafe. Most large communities in Michigan currently have good police immigrant community trust, and there is a real need to obviously stop any threat of violence or harm that's happening while it's happening, and document and develop the record to really understand what's going on. But I also acknowledge what happened in Traverse City and the reality that not all local police are trusted, unfortunately, by immigrant communities. And so in a kind of after-the-fact reporting situation, I would want to urge bystanders and upstanders to be respectful and conscious of the different calculation that the most affected community may have about the value of involving the police or the potential harm associated with involving the police. The Michigan Department of Civil Rights has made a very strong statement, and in our experience, they're a trusted and independent institution established by our state constitution, and they can be reached at 1-800-482-3604.
Susan, President-elect Trump has said he plans to move quickly on immigration. He hasn't given us a lot of specifics, but we might expect him to target deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA, which was a presidential order from Mr. Obama. What effect do you expect this to have on people in Michigan?
Well, there are, you know, thousands of people in Michigan who have the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals work authorization and temporary protection from deportation. I know and love many of them, and they will be tremendously exposed to and vulnerable to deportation because, of course, they've given all of their personal information to the government and identified themselves. These are folks who've lived in the U.S. since they were at least 15 years old and have graduated from U.S. high schools. Many of them have now been in the workforce since 2012. You know, I really want to challenge our leaders who are saying that they're not about the hate to really prove it. Those who've said they're pro-immigrant and they support immigrants, what a great opportunity to step forward and be champions for those with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. The governor often talks about how he wishes we stapled a green card to every college diploma to an international student that's issued. And abolishing the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program is like peeling a work authorization off someone's diploma. I really hope that champions will emerge on both sides of the aisle for people with DACA to protect those folks and stand with them.
Susan, last night on 60 Minutes, Mr. Trump said he's going to move quickly on deportations, particularly undocumented immigrants who he says have committed crimes. He said they'll be either deported or incarcerated, and he said that could be up to 3 million undocumented immigrants. And then said after the border is secure, immigration officials will start making a determination about the remaining undocumented immigrants in this country. But at the very same time, House Speaker Paul Ryan is saying there will not be deportation squads. What is your take on these messages? Are they conflicting?
It's hard to know, but I think something we almost certainly will see is a return to the kinds of workplace enforcement actions that we saw throughout the Bush administration and even early in the Obama administration. There already are deportation squads. They're called Fugitive Operations Teams of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They're incredibly visible in parts of Grand Rapids. They're incredibly visible in Southwest Detroit. There's a real disconnect there, right? Immigrant communities know that Fugitive Operations Teams comb their communities on a regular basis. So it's hard for me to make sense of a promise that there won't be deportation squads. There already are, and I would expect that there would be more, particularly because one of the first 100 days promises is to step back from a lot of the policies that have been put in place to make our current immigration enforcement system more humane. And many of those policies are really important in restraining the way that existing resources are used and existing laws are enforced. So it's not as though it would take some really radical action to see a return to the kind of worksite enforcements where a significant number of people are arrested at a particular place of business and by the end of the day are in a federal detention facility in another state.
And even so, all along, Mr. Trump has said he wants to do these deportations humanely.
Well, I guess I don't know exactly what that means. I mean, to me, someone going to work in the morning, saying goodbye to their kids, putting them on the bus, being detained at their job, and, you know, being in West Virginia or Arizona or Texas in a detention center when they go to bed and being removed from the country without seeing those children or that family again is not humane. But that's exactly what the system is set up to do, and only executive policies and practices have restrained that from being a very, very common scenario in the last 5 to 8 years. I don't know what humane means in that context. I truly don't. And I would love to be surprised, and I would love to see certain policies that are humane stay in place. I'll give you an example. Right now, there is a policy that if you are the sole caregiver of children and you are detained, for example, you're driving, you don't have a license, you're arrested, you're picked up by ICE. Right now, there is a policy that if you have a partner who you share custody with who could take care of those children, you'll stay detained and you'll go through the regular potential bond, or maybe you can't raise the bond, the sort of regular detention process. But if you are the sole caregiver of children, there's a policy, an executive policy in place that you'll be given an alternative to detention, maybe an ankle bracelet, maybe a bond, maybe even simply released pending your deportation court hearing. What I read in the first 100 days plan is that kind of policy goes away.
Susan, millions and millions of Americans were attracted to Mr. Trump's get tough message on immigration. They think that people who are here illegally are free riding on the backs of taxpayers, or that our insecure borders make us unsafe, and that there's a legal system and that it's not fair for people who violate our laws to stay in this country.
Well, for folks who can hear me say this, I want to say that our immigration system has always been designed to perpetuate white supremacy. That is what, in many ways, the rule of law in this country has always been about. And so to boil things down to follow the law or don't follow the law, when so many people have been excluded from the benefits of the law, excluded from the benefits of legal residency and citizenship, even as they were drawn to the U.S. by forces of supply and demand in our economy, even as our agricultural industry, our hospitality industries, just to highlight a few in this state, were enriched by their labor, I think is an oversimplification of the dynamic that's going on here. And I would invite people into deeper relationship with immigrant communities to understand those stories. There are lots of ways that people of goodwill with open hearts can learn more about these issues. All of our major faith communities have excellent resources to help people understand the need for truly humane immigration reform.
Is there a way to take those concerns into consideration, Susan, and also have an immigration policy that you could support?
Sure. There is tremendously rich thinking about how to rebuild our immigration policy. And we've even reached compromises at a number of points in the last decade or so that were poised to bring immigration reform, just reform to the system to make it work better and decrease the incentive for people to migrate in irregular ways. But unfortunately, I mean, I hate to be too pessimistic, but I do feel like these election results represent a repudiation of that approach. And certainly some of the individuals named to the transition team would strongly repudiate those approaches. I would highlight a man named Chris Kobach. The Southern Poverty Law Center has followed his career extensively. His whole career has been built on a rejection of those approaches and a criminalization of immigration. And he's been named to the transition team. There's talk of involving former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio in the administration in some formal way. I don't feel sanguine about this sort of being the moment to talk about immigration reform. Advocates in our communities are looking for champions, but are also thinking about resistance. And I do hope that there is opportunity for continued community building around issues of immigration. We run an initiative called Welcoming Michigan. I certainly would invite people who want to know what to do to take a look. We're going to get a list of resources up soon for people to think about how to build more community around these issues in their local contexts. To me, that's a fruitful place to put your energy. Other actions of solidarity with immigrants are fruitful places to put energy. I don't hear a lot of voices talking about how to get comprehensive immigration reform done in the next Congress or the new administration.
Susan Reed, Managing Attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Susan, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Liz Dickey, Ryan Grimes, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.